Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. This is the second half of an interview with Dale Carrico, the human rights fellow for the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Dale also blogs at the Cyborg Democracy blog and the Amor Mundi blog and writes the Progressive Futures column for betterhumans.com. We left off with a discussion of how the academy makes it difficult for intellectuals to address themselves to the public and doesn't train them to use new technologies in a timely and concise and effective way.
Then on the other hand, as a set of professionalizing rituals, I just don't know that the academy has kept up with technology in the ways it's going to need to. I mean, another example is the Wikipedia, which to me is a more valuable resource than the Britannica in a way. And I mean, that says something. There's no denying the impact of that kind of development over the last couple of years. I don't know where it's going. I don't know what the consequences are going to be.
I'm very sympathetic with the notion that life should be more like the academy. I want to press you on the public intellectual thing for a second, though, because it connects to some of the themes in your recent writing. Because although you've been focusing mostly in your dissertation, you have had time to write, for instance, a two-part essay on the trouble with the term transhumanism, which is you and I don't see eye to eye on, because I am the head of a transhumanist organization, and I'm trying to spread the gospel of transhumanism.
Right.
But, one of the things that I think is at work in this is that I've given up on trying to become an academic, and I work in an academic environment, but I'm no longer concerned about academic validation, and you're just at the beginning of your academic career. And I wonder, and I'm not trying to cast aspersions here, but I wonder if it puts us in two different positions about the problem of the weight and the cultural associations that we can't control that these kinds of terms bring with it. I mean, the same thing I see happening with young socialist folks. People who work in certain milieus aren't concerned about being associated with the term socialism, but people who want to become a professor or something don't give a paper at the Socialist Scholars Conference unless they know that, you know, it's like in sociology maybe it would be okay, but in other fields it wouldn't.
Right, I know what you're talking about. I mean, of course, a whole series of answers immediately comes to my mind. I mean, there's several things to say. One of them is, of course, for me, the most valuable experience I have as an academic actually has nothing at all to do with research and publication, but it's teaching. Right, it's the from term to term conjuring up the community of the classroom and then engaging in that unique set of circumstances with a group of peers and seeing what we come up with, right? That's the thing that has been really valuable for me. And I've been really quite lucky over the last 10 years, especially to teach quite a lot. I've taught hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of enthusiastic, quite bright students. And I've also even been fortunate to talk about quite a lot of the ideas and the books and the works that you and I talk about, right, in an academic setting through the context of the classroom. And so I think that's for me at least unquestionably a valuable experience. I would never want to give it up. I think it's been really quite powerful and wonderful. Cool. The thing about transhumanism, I mean, there's really quite a lot to say. It's weird actually to talk to you about transhumanism of all people, especially given my argument, because there's little question in my mind that if the attitudes and positions that you espouse represented the default culture of transhumanism, I hardly imagine I would be particularly troubled by being called a transhumanist. I mean, I think of you as what, socialist, feminist, Buddhist, bioethicist, and radical Democrat. I mean, what's not to like? But
queer too.
Right, exactly. And I don't think that even remotely represents the default culture of transhumanist identification. For me, I guess one thing to say is I have certain kinds of suspiciousness around identity politics, even at its best, even when it works, right? The thing that identity is supposed to do is confer social intelligibility. And for me, even in the best case where an identity politics does manage to confer social legibility, I think it does it at a cost that's sometimes really high, sometimes somewhat pernicious. I think that there's a kind of policing of conformity among the memberships of of an identity movement that isn't always appealing, things like that. But for transhumanism, at least for me, I don't feel that transhumanism even successfully confers social legibility for me. I often feel that it risks all sorts of distortions of what it is that I'm about, and that just seems very worrisome for me. It seems to impose really high costs for benefits that aren't really as palpable to me.
But we've talked about this before, so you'll be familiar with the way this argument goes, but my reply to that is that all phrases are empty of inherent meaning. We live in a Wittgensteinian universe in which words are only defined by the context in which they're used. And so the challenge is not to come up with some new term, which will come with all of its own associations, but to reclaim and use the terms that we have and the identities that we have in some new way.
Right. I actually don't necessarily, the critique I'm making wouldn't really want to ascend to that level of abstraction at all. I mean, I have very particular worries. I have very particular worries that to be identified as a transhumanist for me risks associating me with, hyper-individualist ethics that I disdain, or market libertarian politics I consider pernicious and kind of embarrassing. It risks associating me with certain kinds of hostility to spiritual practice and creative self-expression. It risks associating me with a certain kind of reductive scientism, a kind of social marginality, hostility to environmentalism, a weird tendency to get bamboozled by corporate hype. I mean, all sorts of things. And again, I mean, I know that none of those things reflect what you mean by transhumanism at all. So you're the last person in the world to talk about this with, in a way. But I think that those associations exist. I mean, I think the term is literally freighted with those legacies. And it's, I don't know, for me, it's rather a high cost to bear, to risk identification with those things, when I think it renders me unintelligible to people who would otherwise sympathize with my perspective. I mean, I think that you have folks like Annalee Newitz or Jaron Lanier, who are heroes of mine, who often say very, very similar sorts of things to the things that we say politically about technology, but then actively disdain the transhumanist term. I think it's because of very specific historical associations, and also possibly because of the kind of currency that bioconservative depictions that are starting to circulate around transhumanism also seem to convey. But I mean, taken together, it just seems to me to be a really high cost. I mean, I don't mean to disdain or denigrate people who are going to participate in like a really kind of risky and costly project to rehabilitate the term or rearticulate its meaning. I think that that's what you're doing. I don't mean to disdain that. It's just, I don't know, it's not for me. I worry that the costs are too high when the kinds of, I don't know, the quandaries that we're talking about, the things that we're worried about in technological development are fairly urgent, some of them. And I think that the kind of project of rearticulating transhumanist identity to better reflect the really good things that you mean by the term, I don't know, I think that they're almost too long-term, really, and too costly to make a lot of sense in the face of the urgencies of the other kinds of political projects that we want to work on. I think that we can focus on a series of very specific developmental outcomes, progressive outcomes in terms of like, funding particular technologies, regulating them to see to it that they're fair, increasing access to technologies to everyone, increasing access to information so that people make informed choices. I mean, all of those things that we talk about, I mean, I think that we can talk about those as a series of progressive outcomes and find a whole lot of allies there, whereas it's hard to always see what contribution adding the transhumanist term to that, what kind of contribution it makes, how it makes that series of efforts more intelligible or easier. I mean, I think for some people it does. I mean, I saw the chart that you do in Citizen Cyborg about the terrain of techno-ethical and techno-cultural politics, right? Where you have the like kind of libertarian transhumanist, the democratic transhumanist, the Luddites of various description, and I think that that depiction of the terrain really has a certain powerful sense. I can see how all of the institutions and the individuals and the temperaments line up in that way. So it does make a certain kind of sense. It's just that I think that that the deployment of the term sometimes frustrates more than it facilitates particular progressive technological politics.
I'm speaking to Dale Carrico. He's a PhD candidate in University of California, Berkeley, and a fellow of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and many, many other things. If you Google Dale, it's C-A-R-R-I-C-O.
And according to Google, I am a transhumanist. quite contrary to anything that I want to say about it.
Yeah. Well, let me say something about that chart, because a chart like that, for me, is both descriptive of what I think is an emerging terrain, so the way things would actually play out in, if we could do the kind of survey analysis or whatever and quantitative analysis that I would like to see done, as well as an intervention. And I think that what you're trying to argue for in some of your recent articles is an intervention that I'm very sympathetic with, which is to say, look, instead of putting these people in this box over here and these people in this box over here, why don't we use terms that put people together in on the same side, that we want together on the same side, even if they have different flavors of their argument. And so the term that you advocate is tech progressive, which would put together someone like Anna Lee Newitz with us, even though Anna Lee has recently written an article where she gives transhumanists the finger, literally, in the article, and because she doesn't like those associations that you talk about, but she would be more comfortable with something like a tech progressive point of view.
One hopes. I mean, although definitely the point isn't to create an alternate tribal designation for people to, like, identify with in particular, right?
Well, it is in part. I mean, that's, I think, again, part of our argument is that you're a rhetorician, I'm a sociologist, and when I look at the history of social movements, I totally agree that that identity politics can be a barrier to certain kinds of things. But the reason that socialists, for instance, hate identity politics is because it took when we had the identity of the worker. 99% of the population could identify with the identity of the worker. You could organize on the basis of the identity of the worker. The Rainbow Coalition doesn't provide any coherent identity or unifying, identity for people to get around. You've got all the different identities, but there's nothing that holds it together, which is one of the reasons why I wrote a book about cyborg citizenship, because I think the notion of radical citizenship and this new expanded notion of citizenship in a transhumanist sense is one of those potential things I would like to see as a unifying post-identity identity.
Mm-hmm.
So, at any rate, let me take us back to gay politics, because I think one of the interesting challenges that comes at us, at people with our tech progressive point of view, are things like what happens if people get a hold of the gay gene and start editing it out of the genome. Now, we talked about that we don't think that the society's going to become bland and everything. But from feminists, we get the concern about sex selection. And from gay rights activists, we get the concern about gay genes. Would your version of tech progressive thought have anything in particular to say about policy ramifications or ways of approaching the question of parents editing their kids' genes for gender and sexual preference?
Right. I mean, when we organized the conference, the Boundaries in Question conference, there were lots of people who participated in feminist and disability studies who participated in the panels. One of them was Marcia Saxton, who is a very interesting and powerful feminist theorist of disability studies, and she gave a really quite passionate speech about her own so-called disability. It's been certainly quite marginal to her capacity to be an unbelievably inspiring and effective person in politics and in the academy. And she spoke really quite emotionally about how what pre-implantation genetic diagnosis or screening or what have you would very likely have screened her out of existence as an inappropriate child. And she wept. It was really quite powerful to say, you know, I'm a valuable person as I am. This disability of mine is not who I am. It doesn't denigrate me and my dignity as a person. And I mean, I have to say, I know that if the gay gene were to be identified, if some sort of screening procedure were available, it is very likely that my mother, whether or not she's homophobic or not, would have screened me out of existence, if only for fear of the kind of homophobia and the kinds of sadness that you have to deal with, presumably, as a result of being gay for that reason. And I know in the aftermath of that that she would have regretted that decision because, I mean, you know, how fabulous could I be? But it seems to me that a commitment to reproductive freedom and to choice has to involve, among other things, the statement that a woman cannot make the wrong choice. She makes the choice that she makes. If my mother had chosen another potential embryo over me, I mean, I have no, as a pre-born creature, I have no greater dignity than the embryo who would have become me than some other. I can't assume that, you know, pre-existential state from which to judge the relative merits or not of beings. I think the choices that women make, whatever those choices are, whatever they imagine the conditions that they confront on the basis of which they make those choices, are always the right ones, and I simply always support them. Do you know what I mean?
I absolutely do know what you mean.
So, I mean, on the other hand, I think that when Marcia Saxton talks about why she is valuable, and when I say that I am valuable, part of the thing that I'm saying is I'm recognizing the existence of certain stupid, irrational prejudices against so-called disabilities, queerness, and the like that already denigrate us in the world today. It's a way of actually calling attention to yet one more variation on this kind of irrational prejudice, you know? And I think that it's important not to confuse the particular kinds of injustice that you're talking about. You're not going to use the fact of the irrationality and damaging nature of homophobia or irrational prejudices against superficial disabilities, right, to justify intervening in the freedom of women over their own bodies. That cannot be the way that particular set of interlocking critiques plays itself out in our understanding of what the progressive position is going to be in this issue. I think that, you know, what we talk about when we talk about cognitive liberty or technological self-determination is, I mean, ultimately we rely on some sort of idea that what we want is a circumstance in which new technologies, emerging technologies, are neither mandated in their use nor forbidden in their use. We want neither, we don't want forcible intervention, nor do we want bans that remove our capacity to choose to make use of technologies, right? We want to support informed choice where emerging technologies come into play. And part of what informed consent has to mean is a more sophisticated engagement with these normative vocabularies through which we decide what kinds of people deserve to be considered people or not, what it means to be valuable, what it means to have a life that is an unlivable life or not. I mean, once technology puts us in a position to actually genocidally erase certain kinds of diversity, then it will never be more clear that the task of the left will be to, you know, once and for all eliminate these myths that people have about what kinds of lives are not worth living. I mean, we're not going to be able to fall back on an inability to intervene technologically in diversity to protect us from, I don't know, some sort of fascistic desire to impose conformity. But I mean, on the other hand, all of those sorts of statements just seem overwrought to me because I think that people are profoundly drawn to the pleasure and danger of difference. I think that it's just as likely or more likely that morphological freedom, that technological interventions are going to create this overwhelming overabundance of forms of being in the world, and that the idea of policing diversity into absolute conformity is a bit of a red herring. And it's quite hilarious to hear that be the principal argument of bioconservatives because, I mean, half of the time when I hear the arguments that bioconservatives make, I suspect that what they're doing is just projecting over and over and over again their own prejudices onto, like, fantasized hyperbolic futures. I mean, they talk about how engineered super babies will reduce our children into objects. It's like it's conservatives, not progressives, who think that it's legitimate kind of parenting to spank your child as an object, right? I mean, they talk about the elimination of diversity through genetic engineering. It's like it's conservatives who are the organization man, the conformist, the unimaginative, fearful person who denigrates and makes fun of diversity and multiculturalism.
I mean, exactly. Having a member of the President's Council on Bioethics say that they're going to keep us from exercising our reproductive rights in order to protect gay people is just a little bit beyond absurd. But, you know, this issue of the limits of reproductive freedom has become much more clear for me since the Indian Medical Council recently recommended that no Indian woman should be allowed to see an ultrasound, and in fact, ultrasounds should be banned in India because it was so impossible to police their potential use for sex selection purposes.
Right.
And what they're basically saying is no Indian woman should be able to know the health of her own pregnancy, the contents of her own womb, and make any decision about it because they're concerned that in 20 years, Indian men, 10% or 15% of Indian men may not be able to find wives and will run amok.
Yeah, it's really quite extraordinary.
And yet Western feminists think, oh my God, we have to go over there and do whatever we can to prevent sex selective abortion, when it, in fact, it's going to keep Indian women from controlling their own reproduction. It's going to force girls to be born into families that in the past used to starve them to death instead of just select them out through abortion, and probably will do so again in the future if you don't change the patriarchy, and for the purpose of ensuring that men can find wives. It's insane to me.
Right, it's quite obvious that there are cultures that denigrate women. It's really quite extraordinary to propose that the way to productively address systematic denigration of women is to impose limits on their own reproductive freedom over their bodies. I mean, it's perfectly absurd.
Now, the same argument I have used with people about the gay gene, which is that why would you think that it does anything? You know, why would you think that forcing gay kids to be born into families who would have selected them out if they could have is the way to change society or it does anything to support gay rights in society? And the flip side of the argument is that is this whole debate about gay essentialism, whether there is a gay gene or not. And
right.
Even if there is a gay gene today, from a transhumanist point of view, in the future, I think we're all going to have increasing amounts of control over our sexual preferences and identities. And people will experiment, and there'll be increasing amount of diversity in the future, whether they're gay genes or not.
Right. Well, I mean, the Kinsey scale is a graduated scale in any case.
Right. Well, that may be because of genetic or hormonal factors.
Right.
But, you know, I had, as a guest maybe 2 years ago, I got interested in this whole question of gay therapy, the rehabilitation therapy for gays. I forget what the Christians call it. But
boy. Right.
There were two studies that came out at the same time about 2 years ago, one from Gay and Lesbian Caucus of the American Psychological Association, and they showed that it didn't work. And then the Christians released a study that showed that it did because they had followed some of the people who had gone through theirs. Well, the people who looked at their study found that actually, 30% were recidivists, you know, went back to being gay after a short amount of time, and not all the rest were very happy. But
I'm sure it brought to you by the same scientists who brought you the safe cigarette and climate change denial.
Right. But it, you know, for me, since I'm not a gay essentialist, I'm someone who has a more social constructivist view of sexual identity. And one of the reasons I have that is because, you know, if you look at things like what are the percentages across the United States of people who say that they're gay, say that they've had same-sex experiences or same-sex desire, you find things like higher education is strongly correlated with that.
Right.
Well, that could either mean that gay people are all and bisexual people are all a lot smarter, which I'm willing to give some credit to. But I think
you haven't been to the same bars I have, clearly.
But I think it also has something to do with the fact that you give people enough stuff in their head and they start to think, well, maybe there are options in life.
Right. I seem to remember John D'Amelio, an historian who made the argument in Capitalism and Gay Identity that it's actually capitalist forms of social organization that created the gay identity, certainly not the physiological or temperamental tendency to find pleasure in the company of other men, at least occasionally, but created the circumstances in which large numbers of people could actually organize a self-identity, a self-narrative around forms of intimacy and association with same-sex partners. Right.
You needed ghettos.
Right.
Yeah, it was Stonewall was Stonewall for a reason.
Indeed.
Yeah. For this last question, I want to reference your most recent article, which is an article titled Progress as Natural Force versus Progress as the Great Work. And it's very interesting that that you write this article because my most recent essay is also a book review of Wesley J. Smith's book on Brave New World. And Wesley J. Smith is someone who in the past would have been considered a progressive. He used to write books with Ralph Nader. I'm not sure. He's been friends now with the right for so long, I'm not sure it's applicable anymore. But at least I argued that his trajectory reflects the trajectory of a lot of progressives who decided they didn't like progress anymore.
Right.
And you're talking here about the two different ideas of progress and why that comes about, why progressives, some progressives don't like progress anymore. So what are you trying to say here?
Well, I mean, I think the kind of proximate inspiration for that brief little essaylet was there is a moment in the second part of the Trouble with Transhumanism columns that we were talking about a moment ago in which I talk about what it means to try to have a progressive politics without nature, a progressive politics that actually repudiates the kind of normative claims that are made in the name of nature. And there's actually quite a venerable progressive tradition of repudiating nature, not just figures like Oscar Wilde, right, who had a kind of aestheticism and socialism that repudiated the natural, or Valerie Solanas, who did the same, or William Burroughs, who did the same. I mean, these are all, for me, kind of technophilic queer heroes, right? But then you have figures like John Stuart Mill, who said of the natural that it is always only just the customary, and it's treated as a kind of natural capacity or trait that is self-evident and can be violated by intervention, and claims are made in the name of it. And so many, many people in the tradition of the left found the very idea of the natural to be a kind of imposition of limits on us, and that it was an emancipatory act to actually repudiate or at least resist the normativity of the concept of the natural. So anyway, I was talking about the natural and the Trouble with Transhumanism a little, and I received some criticisms from some of my environmentalist allies who wanted me to say, for example, well, why don't you just say, for example, that technology is the form that nature, human nature, takes, right? Or why don't you recognize the extent to which what we mean by nature is that we depend for our survival on systems that we imperfectly understand, and so that we should be especially careful when we intervene in them. And it just, I recognize the power of all of those critiques, but it still seems to me that there's something really quite forceful. There's something that's really quite useful for progressive technophiles in understanding the kind of pernicious way that the natural as an ideology plays out. And so I started talking about what it means to be a progressive, and responding to people who said, in a different set of critiques against things that I'd written, it's like, why do you call yourself a progressive in the first place? I mean, some people think that people use the label progressive just to disdain the word liberal, which has supposedly become a bad word in a kind of conservative social environment. Or they say progress has really been a trail of tears. It's been a series of crimes. There's incredible violence has been done in the name of progress. And so, you know, what do you mean when you actually identify as a progressive? I mean, what possibly can you say that's good about progress? And so, I tried to distinguish two different ideas of progress: one natural, and one a kind of collaborative public work, one the work of citizens. And the difference is one in which I think that for natural progressives, the concept of progress functions somewhat similarly to the idea of, say, manifest destiny, right? It's a kind of self-congratulatory fable that you tell yourself to deny the extent to which the power you have is a result of good luck, or the result of it's a way of justifying the bad behavior that you use to maintain the privileges of power. And I think that it's really quite reasonable to criticize that. I think that there are progressive narratives spoken from the chauvinistic position of empire that try to cast subject populations as like developmental atavisms that lack power precisely because they are more primitive than the people who are calling the shots from moment to moment. And I think that the left has a really a healthy and reasonable skepticism of those kinds of claims that happen in the name of progress, claims of inevitability, claims of destiny, claims of self-congratulatory self-justification for privilege, et cetera, right? But what is lost in thinking of progress entirely in those terms is that, I mean, once upon a time, the business of the left was precisely to create circumstances in which people worked together more or less as equals or at least as peers to, like, build a bit of the road together to where we were going, you know? And I think that it's you don't want to lose that. You don't want to lose the sense of progress as a project, as a collective work. And I wanted to defend that in the essay and in the same breath, I suppose, offer up some more reasons for my disdain for nature, which I've expressed in so many other articles.
It's very interesting that I read your thoughts on this right now, because I just started a wonderful novel by the science fiction writer Stephen Baxter. Mm. The novel's called Coalescent, and apparently it's a part of a series of novels that he's written in the same universe. But it's about an alternative organization of human society that lives subterraneanly under Rome, like 10,000 of them or something. And they're descendants of a 1,600-year-old genetic coom cultural experiment that was started back in the 4th century AD. And so half of the novel takes place in the 4th century AD in Britain and in Rome. And it's all about, he's wonderful at explaining and depicting the way that the Roman Empire is falling apart, mm-hmm. led to the Dark Ages, and how this gave an inspiration to the founders of this experiment to create a new kind of civilization. But what he's really good at, you know, another message that comes out of the book is that once the state, if you attack the state and the notion of any kind of collective public good and people using, and just taxes by themselves, whether they're used to keep the king rich or for public works, whatever they're used for, taxes by themselves create a productive economic social dynamic that when you take that away, the farmers don't produce as much, the roads don't get repaired, you know, there aren't soldiers anymore, and everything begins to fall apart. And it's a wonderful book. I wish all the libertarians I knew would read this book, right? Because it's a lesson that seems to be lost on them. And, mm-hmm. you know, I guarantee that the first time they take a life extension pill and it turns out that their skin turns green and falls off, that they're going to be demanding that the FDA should have tested the damn thing.
Well, it's a really strange thing that classical liberal and market libertarian partisans seem to believe that only they have realized that violence and coercion are a bad thing.
Right.
But liberals and Democrats and socialists all have a violent disdain and you know, hatred for public acts of violence and injustice. That's nothing unique to libertarianism. The idea is that through democratic accountability, you create a circumstance in which inevitable asymmetries that would otherwise be abused and produce violence, right? You create a situation in which the legitimacy of the institutions that are empowered to deploy violence have as part of their self-image precisely that they will guard themselves against those abuses. It's only by introducing that basic frailty and vulnerability to violence into the very institutions that will inevitably be empowered to act in violent ways that you can protect yourself from some of the pathologies of violence that they claim to worry about. But what happens instead is that they valorize what they call market exchanges and simply declare by fiat that whatever gets called a market exchange is nonviolent by definition, whatever it actually involves. And they act as though through that kind of terminological domestication to have eliminated the problem of violence from public affairs.
Right.
But it's just a disavowal of ineradicable violence that we're vulnerable to as a basic condition of political existence.
Well, I point to these studies that show that, when we're talking about the idea of progress, one of the signposts that one could point to is that the likelihood of a person dying through violence today is much, much lower than it has been at any other point in history. And in fact,
right.
There seems to be a linear trend of decline of your likelihood of dying from violence. And, for a lot of progressives, I think a lot of progressives lose sight of the notion that we have been engaged in this great work and that our civilization, for all of its flaws, is on a trajectory towards brighter and better things.
Right. It's just unfortunate that so much of what gets called technological development. I mean, so much technocultural discourse is now taking place in the form of like big pharma and General Electric commercials on television that, you know, paint these fabulously new age hyper futurist androidal images on our screens, and it's like the fantasy of the future is ineradicably corporate militarist. And as a result of that set of associations, I mean, the left has come to repudiate the future itself. And, I mean, the left is defined by the future.
I totally agree. Well, Dale, we're going to have to do this again. I've already, I think, had you on for about 3 shows worth of Change Surfer Radio. So,
oh, dear. Well, I hope that you can eliminate at least 1 show's worth of gaps, and awkward silences.
Well, I have the miracle. Through the miracle of technology, all the awkward silences will disappear, but I don't think you had any gaffes. You're pretty much gaff-free. You're so well-spoken. I have been speaking with Dale Carrico, who will soon be known as Dr. Dale, if we have anything to say about it. And he is a blogger at Cyborg Democracy. He has his own blog, Amor Mundi, A-M-O-R Mundi, M-U-N-D-I. He is the human rights fellow at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and he's out there in Berkeley, California. And I really want to appreciate or thank you for coming on today.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
On December 3rd of 2004, the Connecticut Forum hosted a forum on the future of human life and medical science with Arthur Kaplan, Francis Fukuyama, Gina Colada, Lisa Cahill, and Atul Gawande. And it was quite fascinating, and I will be writing soon a column about that experience. But I also had a chance right before that forum to tape brief interviews with Arthur Kaplan and Francis Fukuyama. Arthur Kaplan, of whom I'm a huge fan, and Francis Fukuyama, who apparently doesn't know me from Adam, but does consider me the advocate of one of the most dangerous ideologies in the world, as I ask him about at the very end. So stay tuned for that. First, I'll speak with Arthur Kaplan, and then with Francis Fukuyama. There's a little bit of microphone rustling, but just hang in there. I was at the recent ASBH meeting and wrote it up a little bit and was very impressed with some of the developments that are happening within bioethics. And I just wondered if you thought that my impression that American bioethics is beginning to seriously chafe under the president's consideration that Leon Cass should be the leading bioethicist in the country, and that there's a new aggressiveness. And on the one hand, a kind of left-wing assertion that access issues should come to the fore, and on the other hand, an assertion that the yuck factor ethics that Leon represents shouldn't be representative of bioethics.
Well, it's funny. You're talking to the person who coined the expression yuck factor. And I did it as a way to put down that point of view, that it isn't enough to say my intuitions or my gut feels or my initial responses to something new, what in the trade we call ethical intuitionism, should guide public policy. I don't believe it. I think it's incumbent on those who would withdraw, withhold, or stop a technology to come up with an argument, not just simply say, it makes me uneasy, it makes me squeamish, I don't like it. If we held to that philosophy, we wouldn't have vaccines because that was the initial reaction to them. We wouldn't have open heart surgery because that was the initial reaction to them. So you need to hear the arguments, and I think some of the conservatives, some of the neoconservatives, some of the bioethicists who've been associated with a Cassian view have been unable or unwilling to provide the kind of argument to support their position. So I think bioethics does chafe when it doesn't hear sort of a sound argument. Now, you're also talking perhaps to the antichrist of Leon, in the sense of, I mean, I may be the most vocal critic he's got, and, you know, from where I sit, I think that in some sense, Leon comes out of a minority tradition within bioethics. That point of view has not been the dominant one. It is prominent because it happens to be one that overlaps the president's position. But I'm not sure bioethics has shifted in the sense you were implying. Mm-hmm. It's stuck with a political reality. It's stuck with a policy reality. It doesn't necessarily like it. But I'm not sure You know, it's not as if bioethics produced Leon and then decided that was a bad idea. I think Leon was more a idiosyncratic phenomena coming from that side of the street. All that said, if nothing else has been true, it certainly gave a shot in the arm to bioethics in its internal debates.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going to hear a short interview with Francis Fukuyama, a bioethicist on the President's Council for Bioethics, but also a leading foreign policy intellectual at Johns Hopkins University. The neuroenhancement issues that the President's Council is supposed to be taking up in this, in the course of this, and if there's anything you can tell us about the thinking and deliberations and perhaps policy ramifications that the President's Council... I know that you haven't been talking very much about policy, but...
Well, mostly what we've done is a kind of fact-finding exercise to this point. The structure of the problem in cognitive neuroscience is a little bit like in genetics, because they're developing methods for doing brain scans and neural imaging and PET scan so forth that will ultimately correlate individuals with certain kinds of behaviors. And so in a way it's sort of like genetic markers. And then that raises privacy questions and then questions about whether you can manipulate, you know, those characteristics and use them for control or, you know, use them for insurance purposes. The one thing that I became completely convinced of in listening to the various scientists that testified on this is that the state of the science itself is so primitive that we're not anywhere close, to being at a point where this is going to be, a problem I think that we're going to have to worry about. So that was my personal take, which probably means that the council, I think we've been trying to figure out whether there really is a serious ethical issue here, and I'm not quite sure that we've, we found one yet.
Mm-hmm. Because the brain's too complex. But you know that the NSF initiative for converging technologies has called 2 years ago for a cognitive sciences, 10-year initiative to try to figure out some of these questions using converging information technologies and whatnot. I presume that that's not one of the things that the President's Council would be enthused about.
Well, I don't know why we wouldn't be necessarily. I mean, I think that it's going to happen, and it's probably the most important, in a sense. I'm a political scientist, and it seems to me that once you get a real cognitive neuroscience going, that's going to be tremendously consequential, because it really will give you a scientific, understanding of the biology of human behavior. And I don't have any objection to that at all, particularly. I don't know why the council would either, but I do think that we're still a very long way, away from that, because the complexity of the human brain is just orders of magnitude, more than anything that else I think that science deals with. So I just don't think that it's a near-term issue.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you're a political scientist, and one of the other huge area in which you're an expert is international foreign policy type questions. Recently, there was a very public break between yourself and some other members of the President's administration when you announced that you disagreed with the Iraq foreign policy, and one of the other people that you disagree with is on the President's Council. I wonder if it creates are there new currents in conservative thinking in bioethics and in foreign policy, or is this simply restricted to foreign policy?
Well, I think this is one of the fundamental misunderstandings of the President's Council. I mean, it was a very diverse group of people to begin with. And so, for some reason, the view got out very early on that this was a group of very like-minded, pro-life, Neanderthal, anti-science people. Whereas, in fact, of the original 17 that now went to 16 members, I think five of them were strongly pro-life, another four were scientists that were completely libertarian, and then there's a whole bunch of people that were somewhere in the middle, which is where I count myself. And so that diversity, I think, always existed. And then, there's a real divergence just among, people that are right of center between those that are, basically religiously motivated, pro-life, and then people like me who is, I've never been pro-life, and I, all of my concerns about any of this stuff are really, in terms of, political consequences or social control or, other things other than, this is true of Leon Cass, the chairman as well. I mean, we really hate having to get bogged down in these discussions of embryos because it's just fruitless, and if you either believe that they're human beings or you don't, and it's not a very fruitful, ethical discussion. So I think that they're really, you really can overestimate how much homogeneity there was on the council. And
you point up another one of the divergences just within the conservative coalition, and that is between the free market forces and the religious right, which now that they're in ascendance, both are in ascendance, they may come at more loggerheads than they had in the past. That seemed to be reflected in the President's Council, for instance, in the Responsibility and Reproduction report, because there was an initial push to have more of a regulatory advice, as I understood it, come out in that report for more regulation of embryologic and reproductive technology. And then there was a certain amount of pressure from the infertility. You don't think that's correct?
No, that's not right. Well, first of all, that report was signed by all members of the council, so it reflected a unanimous decision. Now, what happened was that the early drafts of the report, you see, the target of that report was nothing that the current assisted reproduction, you know, practice of medicine does. I mean, that was not the target. And I think that the staff, when they were drafting the report, well, actually, I probably should not say this on the record, but let me, if you could just...
Sure.
If we could back this I think that there was a bit of a misunderstanding in some of the early versions of the report that made, people in ASRM and SART, you know, the two organizations representing the reproductive medicine, worried that this was somehow aimed at current practices, and that was never the intention on the part of anybody. It's really kind of, new technologies are going to enter through, this channel. I mean, it's going to happen first in an IVF clinic, and so I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are we getting the high sign?
Yeah, we're getting the high sign.
Okay, can I get one more question? One more minute?
It's a quick answer.
Got to be a quick one.
Okay. In Foreign Policy, you recently wrote that transhumanism was the most dangerous idea in the world. I must have raised the eyebrows of some of your colleagues. Is this still your position?
I don't think I said it's the most dangerous. I just, they were soliciting suggestions for what were dangerous ideas, but not broadly recognized as such, and this was, my favorite one. And yes, I had been done by extropians and transhumanists that want to debate me about, cryogenically, preserving themselves and enhancing themselves 120 years from now. So, right, I have gotten into, I don't take up these arguments when they challenge me, but yes, there is a faction out there that wants to do that.
On October 22nd to 24th, 2004, the Foresight Institute, a nanotechnology policy think tank, held a conference on public policy and nanotechnology in Washington, D.C., and they had a speaker there named Adam Kuiper, who is a managing editor at the conservative magazine The New Atlantis, which focuses on biopolitics issues in Washington, D.C., and a variety of other topics, science and technology topics, and is very closely tied to Leon Kass and the conservative folks at the bioethics, President's Council on Bioethics there. And Adam, I don't know, he's like 25 years old or something, he gave a talk at the Foresight meeting, which he was trying to be very actively involved with. He ran a blog for the whole meeting. And he gave a talk which basically said that the reason that Foresight Institute folks and the molecular manufacturing wing of the nanotechnology researchers were losing out in the battle for federal funding was because they were too closely tied to futurism and transhumanism. And so I thought I'd play you that bit of his talk because it's very interesting to hear it from the conservatives. And I mean, basically, they control all the different wings of the government, and yet he thinks it's most important to be out there intervening in nanotechnology politics to get nanotechnologists to disavow their interest in transhumanism. So again, this is Adam Kuiper from The New Atlantis speaking at a Foresight meeting in Washington, D.C., October 24th, 2004.
I'd recommend an effort to distance nanotechnology from the agenda of transhumanists and others who might be considered to be, on the fringes. This is, I think, probably the most sensitive subject I might touch on, so I hope you'll allow me to dwell on it for a moment before I wrap up in completion. This recommendation is based on my estimation of what the future political landscape on questions of cutting-edge technology advances will look like. As you know, many political issues raised by advances in science and technology tend to cut across conventional political boundaries. You could clearly see this last night in the debate about privacy. Who was the liberal and who was the conservative in that debate? Much the same thing, I think, is going to happen in American technopolitics in the coming years. We've written about this in the New Atlantis, and a few other writers like Ron Bailey, who was here yesterday. I don't know if he's here today. I don't see him. Ron Bailey from Reason Magazine have also written cogently about this. You can get a hint of the sort of cross-cutting divisions that I'm talking about by looking at today's bioethics debates. They've divided the political landscape in very strange ways. It's possible nowadays to find right-wingers who have much in common on bioethics questions anyway, with left-wingers whose prose drips with Marx. That's because those debates aren't between right or left. They're very different, and I think neither will the debates about transhumanism or the debates about the subjects that Ray Kurzweil talked about the other night really be divisions between conventional right and left. They're debates between two fundamentally different ways of understanding the world and of understanding human nature. On the one side, in this great political realignment, is the extremist grandson, you might think of it as the extremist grandson of the Enlightenment vision of a rational mind that can understand the world. It's a vision, it's a movement of extreme, I think, materialism, of extreme reductionism, a view of the world where perfection is attained from the molecule up, and of a kind of trend of turning everything into parts and pixels and processes, and of saying whatever can be done ought to be tried without a concern for whether necessarily it's the wise thing to do. And on the other hand, is a very different view of the world, one that appreciates, I think, the wonders made possible by modern science and technology, but that believes also in the dangers of human hubris, in the limits and failings of extreme rationality, one that keeps an eye not just toward what is gained as science marches onward, but also toward what is lost. Ray Kurzweil used a term the other night that I'd never heard, but I looked it up. It's on Google. A couple other people have used it. He talked about fundamentalist humanists to describe the sort of people that I'm talking about. Fundamentalist humanism. I think the first word is unnecessarily derogatory, but the second term is closer to the mark. Those on this side have a different understanding of and appreciation for, I think, human nature and human limits and human mortality. The debate between these two fundamentally different ways of seeing the world is likely to change the political landscape in the coming decades. And now, to tie this back to what I was talking about earlier about the political advice I was giving, if you want to achieve your political goals in the coming decades, I think it's critically important not to get your ideas and issues entangled in that debate. It isn't clear which side, if either, will become dominant in the coming years, and that's why I think you should put more distance between the questions of nanotechnology on the one hand and the questions which are related, raised by transhumanism and posthumanism and extropianism and the singularitarians and the rest. Your association in the public mind with those futurist fringes, I think, brings you no benefit but can do you harm. In conclusion, I hope you'll see the vision that I've laid out, the vision of nanotechnology politics, not as suffocation of your imagination, not as selling your soul, but maybe simply as what might be called a tactical adjustment for the sake of relevance. American politics, rightly understood, is our society's way of seeking after wisdom. It's the clash of interests and ideas and ideologies all forced through the ringer of public argumentation and deliberation. It can be messy, or heartbreaking, or tedious, or scandalous, or molasses slow, or lightning fast. And by making public arguments, by seeking to listen and to persuade, by making exertions actually in the arena, by proposing and fighting for what specifically should be done today to prepare for a better tomorrow, instead of just talking about what should ideally come to pass, by doing all these things, you'll go far to prepare the world for the promise and the peril of nanotechnology. I hope you give it a try. And I hope the world has the wisdom and the courage to heed your advice. Thank you very much.
I want your cheeks to be rosy, your lips like the color of wine. Darling, the way that people will say that, my, but you're looking so fine. Ooh,
I want to. is a hollow, a sturdy and masculine sheep. Darling, the way that people will say that, my, what a gorgeous physique. If you want to be like I want you to be, follow this carefully. You've got to eat your spinach, baby. That's the proper thing to do. It'll keep you kind of healthy, too. And what it did for Papa, it will do for you. You've got to eat your spinach, baby. To give you lots of TNT. For whenever you're caressing me, then you'll need every vitamin from A to Z. Please take my advice. Kissing is dangerous, doctors all agree.
I'll take your advice. Don't ever kiss anybody but me.
You've got to eat your spinach, baby. If you do, you can't go wrong. For it's gonna make you nice and strong. And the stronger you are, the longer you live, and the longer I'll have to love you.
Pardon me, did I hear you say spinach?
Spinach.
I represent all the kids of the nation who sent me to see you about it. I bring a message from the kids of the nation to tell you we can do without it. Kindly listen to me. I'm not alone in my plea. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of us. Nephews and nieces and cousins of us. They want me to say hallelujah, hallelujah. No spinach, take away that awful greenery. No spinach, give us lots of jelly beanery. We positively refuse to budge. We like lollipops, we like fudge, but no spinach. Hosanna!
You've got to eat your spinach, baby.
No, 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 no. I'm singing to ya. No, 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 no. Hallelujah, spinach. Stay away from my door.
We'll tell the boogeyman. The big, big, bad, bad boogie boogeyman.
Oh, that's just a bluff. You know we don't believe that stuff.
You gotta eat your spinach, baby. Children have to do as they are told.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Children shouldn't be so very bold.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Or you grow up to be a meanie when you're old.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. I will tell all the kids of the nation who sent me to see you about it. Children have to do what they are told.
Mm-hmm.
Children shouldn't be so very bold.
Mm-hmm.
Or you will be a meanie when you're old. So, oh, spinach!
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.